Flashman and the Angel of the Lord, by George MacDonald Fraser, continued. Cassette 8, side 1.
It came from the Potomac Bridge, where, unseen by us, that Canadian half-wit Taylor was putting a bullet through the top hair of an inopportune railway guard who had happened along, been challenged, shown fight, and got his skull creased for his pains. We heard him, soon enough, bolting out of the covered bridge, roaring and bleeding and taking refuge in the wager house. And so help me, no one emerged to protest or even inquire. The town slept on undisturbed. J.B. left off contemplating to stare towards the hotel, but did nothing. Our fellows confined themselves to intelligent questions like, "Who the hell was that?" and, "Say, did you hear shooting?" And nothing further took place until there came a distant whistle from far down the Baltimore and Ohio track. And presently in steams the eastbound night train for Baltimore, clanking past the armory and coming to a slow halt near the wager house, only 50 yards from where I stood. At which point the wounded railwayman erupted from the hotel, clutching his bleeding scalp and bawling that there were road agents on the loose. The train engineer, silly ass, got down to investigate. Watson Brown and his idiots opened fire for no apparent reason. An unfortunate nigger, not one of ours, came striding down the track, was challenged by Watson, turned to run, and was shot in the back. The engineer leapt back into his cab and reversed 20 yards with great blasts of steam. Some stout parties in the coaches began blazing away at Watson's party. Passengers were screaming and tumbling from the train. Harper's Ferry began to wake up at last. J.B. strode to the train, bellowing for everyone to hold his fire and be calm. And your correspondent began to wonder if this mightn't be a good time to retire. And would have done if Joe hadn't been holding a pistol in each hand and demanding to know what the hell was happening. Either because of J.B.'s thundering, or more probably because neither side could see properly what they were shooting at, the firing died away after a few moments, and there followed a remarkable conversation between our leader and the engineer. It began, predictably, with J.B. announcing that he'd come to free the slaves at all hazards and in the name of universal liberty, God helping. And the engineer calling him a liar, a lunatic, and a damned jayhawking rascal who'd swing for this. And by the eternal, the engineer would be there to see him do it too. J.B. rebuked him for blasphemy, assured him that no harm was intended to the train or its passengers, and that he would let them proceed so that the railroad authorities should understand that the town was closed to traffic henceforth. The engineer damned his eyes and said he'd swim through seas of blood rather than budge before dawn, when he would inspect the bridge, to see what mischief you infernal scoundrels have done to it. J.B. agreed and promised to walk over the bridge before the train, which he did, by the way, to show that it was safe. The discussion took some time, with frequent interruptions, for you must imagine it taking place in darkness, illuminated only by the train's headlight and the feeble lamps of the nearest buildings, against a background of babbling passengers being helped into the wager house, men shouting, females screaming, the shot darkie being carried away, a church bell belatedly sounding the alarm, bewildered citizens seeking enlightenment at the tops of their voices, and some of the bolder spirits who emerged from the shadows for a closer look being seized by our fellows at the armory gates and sent to join the prisoners in the shed. But no one from the town showed fight, for several good reasons. It was too dark to tell properly what was taking place. A rumor had spread through the town that we were over 100 strong. And while the arsenal was bursting with weapons, there was hardly a gun in the town, except for a few fowling pieces and the like. So, while we held our positions, and J.B. continued to do nothing, the people kept their distance, except for one cool hand, a doctor, who approached the arsenal, was given the right about by Hazlitt, and then crossed the street bold as brass to demand of J.B. what he thought he was about, and on being told, denounced him for a murderer. "The only black you've liberated so far is one who was free already, the poor fellow you shot down on the tracks." He was a peppery medico, this, with a jaw like a pike and the darkies gall all over his hands. "Look at that!
He's dying this minute with your bullet in his lung, you old blackguard.
J.B. said he was sorry for it, but the man had run when called on to halt, and the doctor must consider himself a prisoner.
Just try it, mister,
cries the sawbones,
or shoot me in the back, why don't you?
And he stamped off to the wager house, stopping on the way to survey us, and Hazlitt at the arsenal. And if ever a man was taking stock, he was. Sure enough, 2 hours later, he was riding hell for leather for the nearest town to turn out the militia. And meanwhile, J.B. was waiting and doing nothing, hardly answering when spoken to. And our fellows were fidgeting and muttering, and Joe was growling at me. Why wasn't the captain taking a halt of things, and why didn't I tell him? I said I'd told him, hadn't I? And every moment my gorge was rising higher with panic, as I wondered if I dared make a run for it. There was a clatter of wheels from the dark, and here came a fine four-horse vehicle wheeling into the armory gates, with 3 white men and about 12 darkies aboard, and Stevens jumping down, rifle in hand. He helped down one of the whites, a bluff old cove in a grey coat who I guessed was Washington, and I heard him sing out, "This is Osawatomie Brown of Kansas," as J.B. strode forward to meet them. One of our darkies jumped down after them, brandishing a sheathed saber and calling out, "He tis, Captain, head old sword, sure enough." And J.B. seized on it and stood with it in his hand, as he told Washington that he'd been taken for the moral effect it would give to our cause, but he would be shown every attention. "And if we get the worst of it, your life will be worth as much as mine." Whatever that meant. Washington took it mighty cool, saying nothing, and presently he and the 2 other whites, a man and a youth, were put in the yard, and J.B. supervised the distribution of pikes to the slaves in the captured carriage, telling them they were free men now and must defend their liberties. And the poor black buggers stood in terrified bewilderment, looking at the pikes as though they were rattlesnakes. "A fine rebellion we're going to have," thinks I. "Oh, well, they'll shape better, no doubt, when they've built their forts in the hills and dug communicating tunnels." I kept clear of all this, but so did Joe, damn him, and my gorge rose another couple of notches, for the dark was beginning to lift slowly, and I could see clear to the nearest houses of the town, where people were peeping out, and some even gathering on the corners, staring across at us. There were faces at the windows of the wager house, and hard by it, where the train stood, passengers were climbing aboard with scared glances in our direction. In the armory yard all was confusion, for the prisoners had been let out of their shed and were mingling with the newcomers in a great babble of voices. The niggers with the pikes looked ready to weep, and our men were watching anxiously as Stevens and Tid clambered around J.B., who now had the sword girt round his middle and was exulting over a brace of barkers, presumably the property of the late Marquis de Lafayette.
"Wow, we got more prisoners here than there is of us,"
Tid was exclaiming, and Stevens was arguing with J.B. about loading up from the arsenal and getting nowhere. J.B.'s notion was to send Washington's carriage, which was larger than our wagon, over into Maryland to collect the Kennedy farm weapons, which Owen would have shifted by now to his schoolhouse closer to the Potomac, and bring them back to supplement the arms in the arsenal. Stevens frowned in dismay. "But, Captain, 'twill be full light in an hour. See here, why don't we load up the carriage and the wagon from the arsenal now with everything we need? Call in Kagi and Oliver, and all of us hightail it out of here. We can pick up Owen and the arms from the schoolhouse and be in the hills fore noon." He gestured towards the houses where more people were assembling, watching us. "Look at them folks yonder. How long they gonna let us alone, you reckon?" J.B. gave him a stern look.
"You forget, Captain Stevens, that it is here, at the ferry, that the slaves will rally to us. Why, if we were to leave now, we should be abandoning them. No more of that, sir."
"Well, I don't know that the slaves are coming," says Stevens. "We saw no sign of them when we came in just now, I can tell you."
"And it'll take 3 hours, easy, to get to the schoolhouse and load up and come back here again," cries Tid.
"Then we got to clear out the arsenal. Captain, it'll be noon before we can get out of town. Why, the militia'll be here by then."
"And come dawn, these folks are going to see how few we are."
I could see Stevens was keeping his temper with difficulty. "They ain't going to stand by." J.B. stilled them with a raised hand, like a patient parent.
The hostages are our assurance of safety. The people will dare nothing against us for fear of harming them. And I will not desert the Negroes.
He became peremptory.
Captain Tidd, you and Captain Lehman and Cook will take the carriage away and receive our pikes and rifles from Owen.
But they're three of our best men, sir.
Stevens was near despair.
I beg you, send but one and some of the slaves.
But J.B. was deaf to all common sense, and presently the carriage rolled off over the Potomac Bridge, with Cook at the reins and Tidd and Lehman marching alongside, with a gaggle of the freed darkies in the back.
Stevens pleaded with J.B. at least to start clearing the arsenal.
First, I must keep my promise to the engineer, says J.B.
And off he went to the train, his rifle cradled in his arm and his sword trailing in the mud, halloing to the engineer that he might get up steam.
The townsfolk across the way set up a murmur at the sight of his commanding figure striding towards the tracks, but he paid them no mind at all, and presently the train was chugging slowly onto the covered bridge, with the old man striding ahead of it, and the crowd before the wager house fallen silent.
By gad, he's cool, says Stevens to me. Too damn cool. I tell you, Josh, we ain't got but a couple of hours before we'll have to shoot our way out. What ails him? He acts like we was in a town meeting.
It was true, and everyone who was through Harper's Ferry will tell you the same. The chancier things got, the calmer grew J.B., as though we were in the grip of some soothing drug.
Stevens swore through his teeth.
We've got to get John Kagi down here. He'll take heed of Kagi.
And pat on his words, there was a commotion at the wager house, and one of our niggers came running from under the trees, brandishing his sharps. The folks scattered to let him through, and he came panting up to tell us he was from the rifle works, and Kagi wanted to know when J.B. planned to retire from the town, because he'd seen a rider galloping along the Charlestown Road.
Damnation, what I say,
cries Stevens. It's but 8 miles off. 2-3 hours, we'll have the militia on us.
The crack of a shot interrupted him, sending us scurrying behind the armory railings, and then came two more from somewhere in the town. There was a shrilling of women as the people gave back to the houses, except for one fool who made a dart across the street towards the arsenal. One of our men, the younger Thompson, I think, loosed a shot at him, and he threw up his hands and flopped down in the mud to a chorus of screams and oaths from the wager house. A couple of men ran out, crouching, and hauled him away. Stevens bawled, "Stand to, men!" And every rifle was trained on the town, but now J.B. was striding towards us from the Potomac Bridge, coat flapping, calling to hold our fire. A man came hurrying from the wager house, waving his hands as though appealing for calm, and J.B. stopped to talk to him, and presently nodded and came on to us, while the other scampered back to safety. No further shots came, but our fellows stayed at the armory railings, and behind them the prisoners cowered down, all save old Washington, who stood his ground, arms akimbo.
"Those were only squirrel rifles," says G.B., unconcerned. "There will be no more of that, but be at the ready, men, and keep up a bold front."
"Captain," says Stevens, "this won't do. We're in no case to fight, just a handful here and the rest spread all over."
"There will be no call to fight," says J.B. "The prisoners are our security."
"If you count on that, sir, you are in error."
It was Washington, loud and steady, not stirring a foot.
"Captain Brown, you must give over this madness. Either lay down your arms or avoid the town."
"Odd word to use," I remember thinking. "Look yonder, sir. You have put the people in fear. You have shot a man down. You hold us captive here. All to no purpose. Give it up, sir, before worse befalls."
He was full of spunk and sense, the old soldier, both of which were wasted on our ragged Napoleon. He lifted a commanding hand to Washington.
"Be silent, sir. I have my purpose, as you shall learn, you and all others who live by human bondage. Not another word, sir."
He stood a long moment, glaring like the wrath of God, and then looked about him, taking a slow survey of the scene, turning on his heel his rifle at the port. It was full light now, and all plain to see. Our men kneeling or standing behind the railings, pieces presented. Behind them, Washington, four square among the prisoners. Across the street to our right, the houses with people peering out of the alleys in nervous silence.
the arsenal with Hazlitt and his chum in the doorway, rifles ready. The wager house with faces at every window and at least a score of folk on the porch, and others under the trees beyond, where Galt's saloon could be seen with a couple of fellas sitting on the roof. A few more by the railroad tracks. Hidden from our view by the wager house, Watson and Taylor were on guard at the Potomac Bridge. And not a sound, except for the distant wail of the train whistle far away on the Maryland shore. A light rain was falling again, pattering in the muddy puddles. Everyone just stood, waiting on that gnarled, bearded old scarecrow in his soiled coat and ragged hat, his ridiculous saber trailing at his side. He finished his survey and fixed Washington with a grim, burning stare. "If any are in fear, it is a judgment on the sins of their guilty land. If any die resisting a just cause, then they have brought it upon themselves. As to the purpose of your own captivity, I have told you it was a moral one, and also because, as aide to the governor of Virginia, you would have endeavored to perform your duty, and perhaps you would have been a troublesome customer to me." He thrust a finger like a handspike towards Washington. "I shall do my duty also, and to a higher power than a slave state. I shall be very particular to pay attention to you, sir, on my word."
He paused, growling deep in his chest, and turned to Bill Thompson at the railing.
"Captain Thompson, how many hostages are under guard? 30, you say? So many? Why, that is twice our own number. Well, now, we must take account of that."
He leaned his rifle against the gate and stood glowering at the prisoners with his hands resting on his pistol butts, his lips moving as though in calculation, and I felt the hairs rise on my neck.
"Sweet Jesus, what's he about?"
gasped Stevens.
"Is he crazy?"
A rhetorical question, if ever I heard one, with the old death's head glaring like Dragfoot the hangman. And then he swung towards our group, hitching his sword hilt out of the way and fumbling in his pants pocket. He lugged out a handful of the eagles Merriam had given him, glancing across at the wager house as he sorted the coins on his palm.
"Joel Simmons," says he, "here is $15. I want you to go to the hotel yonder and tell them we require hot breakfast for 45 persons to be served to us here, oatmeal and milk, and some of their southern fry of eggs and ham. Whatever they have, you understand? Oh, and Joe, they'll send coffee, no doubt, but tell them I desire a pot of tea also."
I suppose Cardigan's walk, march, trot at Balaclava is the most memorable battlefield command I've ever heard. But J.B.'s order for breakfast at Harper's Ferry runs it close. For a moment I didn't believe it, and neither did Joe, for he stood gaping at the coins in J.B.'s hand. And then his glance flickered in my direction, and I knew at once what he was thinking, that if he went off to the wager house, who was going to keep an eye on slippery B.M. Comer? For a second he hesitated, and then the clever beggar saw his way out.
"Why, Captain, I can't do that," says he. "They won't pay no heed to a colored man, no sir. They'll mind what Master George says, though, and I can go along and help carry, maybe."
"And some fools say they're not fit to vote." The hope that had leapt in my breast died in a smouldering inward rage as J.B. nodded and handed me the money, only to revive again at the thought that the crowded confusion of the wager house might give me the opportunity I'd been praying for. All I'd need was a split second to get out of reach and range of Joe, and then either try to flee the town or declare myself to some responsible citizen as a government agent. But God, that would be risky. They'd never believe me. J.B. broke in on my thoughts.
"Leave your rifles and revolvers. They will offer you no violence, knowing that we hold their friends hostage."
I didn't hesitate, but drew the two Colts from my hip holsters and passed them to Stevens, along with my sharps. Joe's eyes rolled and his ugly mouth tightened, but then he, too, passed over his pistols. J.B. said,
"Remember the tea, Joshua."
And we set off side by side across the open ground towards the wager house, one of us casting wary sidelong glances, the other with the reassuring pressure of the tranter tucked into the back of his waistband under his coat. It was an interesting walk in its way, under the astonished eyes of the citizens, wondering what the deuce it meant. Two of the desperadoes who were holding their town to ransom suddenly strolling over to their hotel. For a moment the crowd on the porch stood goggling, and then there was a flurry of skirts and squealing as the women shrank away. And some of the men drew back, although most stood pat, hostile but scared. I played up, tipping my hat and calling a cheery good morning as we mounted the steps. And one of the men even thrust the door open for us to pass through, crying, "John! Someone get John Fulce, quick! They're coming in!" For a moment it was like upsetting a bee's nest as we strode in, for the lobby was full of anxious citizens, as was the dining area off to one side. And the advent of a stalwart ruffian with whiskers and a massive black of forbidding mien had them almost clambering over each other. I calmed them with an upraised hand and my best speech day style, assuring them they had no cause for alarm, that Captain Brown presented his compliments and would be withdrawing from their delightful township presently, and that in the meantime they should remain at ease while I spoke to a waiter. There was a moment's stunned silence, and then cries of, "He's a foreigner!" and the like, and a red-faced worthy in a tile hat shouting, "What do you mean by it? What do you want of us? And who are you?" And a woman fainted, and another woman screamed, and all was confusion until I raised my voice again, and presently a small, bald trembler in a white apron and an extremity of terror emerged, and I gave him my order for 45 breakfasts. Strangely enough, it seemed to have a calming effect on the assembly, if not on the hash slinger. His teeth chattered and he closed his eyes, babbling that he didn't know if Cookie could handle that many at such short notice, and he'd have to see, and oh my God, he'd do his best, and finally, this is unvarnished truth, in a shrill whinny, "Say, mister, how do you want the eggs?" "At your discretion, my boy," says I. And he stared witless before scurrying away, muttering, "Discretion? And for all I know, they're serving oeufs à la discretion in Harper's Ferry to this day." Well, I took a quick slant about me. 50 folk, if there was one. Pale faces and round eyes, women shrinking, men resolute but doubtful, every head in the dining section turned to stare, whispers and scared murmurs. No other door off the lobby, but one beyond the dining tables, obviously to the kitchen. Straight ahead of me, a big bar counter with gilt mirrors behind. A staircase leading to a balcony above the lobby. A young negress looking down over the rail. And here I paused in astonishment at the bizarre contrast of bottle-bright red hair tumbling about shiny ebony cheeks. A plump black hand clutching a silk peignoir round a form which would have done credit to a Turkish wrestler, and bold, protruding eyes regarding me with, unless I was mistaken, which I seldom am, awakening interest. I stared and received an unexpected, dazzling beam of white teeth in return. "How many more of us you're aiming to kill, you damn brigand?" It was my red-faced worthy again, waving a fist in my face. "There's a corpse a-layin' in back yonder, and a nigger like to die." "And that's Brown the abolitionist out yonder," cries another. "Him and his gang of Kansas murderers, and you skunk, and this black villain got the gall to bust in here asking to be fed."
"Shame, shame on you,"
squawks a female. And then they were surging about us, spitting and cursing. A fist swung at my head. I ducked, and my assailant blundered into Joe, tumbling him over. My hand was on the tranter, and Joe, sprawling, was conjuring a Colt from his armpit. A fella dived on him, grabbing his wrist. The squawking woman was belaboring me with her gamp. Joe was hurling his attacker aside, but by that time I was going through the dining section like Spring-Heeled Jack, sending a table flying as I plunged through the kitchen door. One backward glimpse I had of Joe, rearing, gigantic and bellowing as the mob fell back before his pistol. And then I was face to face with a wizened black granny flourishing a skillet, a kitchen in uproar, and my little waiter on his knees crying, "'Twon't be but a moment, Mr. Honest!' There was a door ajar to my right. I leapt through, slamming it behind me, and found myself in a passage with a door to the open air and a flight of stairs running up, and I was just about to choose the former when there was a tremendous crash and screaming from the kitchen, with Joe bawling, "Way'd he go? You see a white man, woman?" He wasn't 5 seconds behind me. If I broke into the open, he'd nail me for certain. I bounded up the stairs, through a door at the top, and crouched, wheezing with terror, in a deserted passage, while the sound of a raging blackamoor bursting from the hotel in vain pursuit sounded below. Then I tiptoed forward past closed doors on either side, wondering where the hell I could hide, came to the end of my passage, and dropped prone as I realized it opened slap onto the balcony above the lobby. There was uproar down yonder, and someone was clattering up the main staircase towards me. I had no time to retreat. There was a closed door to my right. I grabbed in panic at the knob, rolled hastily within, thrust it shut, and came to my feet, tranter in hand, and an ear to the panels, my heart pounding as I heard the steps go past. Someone gasped in the room behind me, and I whipped round with a yelp of fear to find myself confronting my dusky Amazon of the balcony, hennaed hair a-tumble, hands raised in amazement. I gave a frantic croak of, "No, don't call out," and she blinked, eyes popping at the tranter, but she didn't faint or have hysterics, and when I shoved it back beneath my coat, she rolled her eyes and let out an elaborate sigh of relief, followed by a shrill giggle.
"Well, here's a go. Ma, can't you move around, though?"
She raised a whimsical eyebrow.
"You just passing through, or you kindly planning to stay? I hope."
I'd no time to marvel at the presence of a gaudy and eccentric negress en déshabillé in a southern hotel, or the nonchalance with which she greeted an armed intruder. "Madam," cries I, "don't be alarmed, I beg. I mean no harm, I swear, but I'm in a slight pickle, you see. Hold on, do." I sped to the front window and peeped through the curtains. There, not 50 yards off, were the armory gates, with J.B. and Stevens in plain view and the fellas at the railings. To the left was the arsenal, with the townhouses beyond. There were a few citizens by the houses, and one bold spirit was shouting and shaking his fist in J.B.'s direction.
"What in creation's happening out there?"
demands the Queen of Sheba.
"An election? Sounds like Sacramento on 4th of July. Who you running from, handsome? The vigilantes?"
I hopped to the room's other window, which overlooked the railroad tracks, and the Potomac. It was a corner room, as you'll see from my map, and started back as Joe suddenly appeared beneath, by the side of the hotel, Colt in hand, staring about him. There was a knot of people by the tracks, scattering away from him as he turned and shouted, and I realized he must be addressing Watson at the bridge entrance behind the hotel. Then he set off for the armory gates, waving and shouting to J.B., no doubt asking him how he'd like his eggs. I crouched, watching, until a husky voice spoke reproachfully behind me.
"Well, you sure know how to flatter a fine colored lady. Or is the view out there more pleasing than the one in here?"
I turned, still breathless, to find her regarding me with a quizzy amusement that took me even more aback than her extravagant appearance. This was the South, mind, where darkies knew their place. But here was one, young, sassy, and black as your boot, who carried herself like a Dahomey duchess, and looked the white boss in the eye with cheerful insolence. She must have read my thought, for she tossed that astonishing fiery head.
"I's free, case you're wondering,"
says she tartly,
"and I'm waiting."
When in doubt, grovel. "I beg your pardon, ma'am. Believe me, I can explain. Those men yonder are abolitionist raiders."
"So I've been told,"
says she coolly.
"You likewise?"
No, not at all. The fact is I'm a government man. I was with them to observe them, you see, find out what they were up to."
"You don't say. Well, think of that."
Her eyes widened in mock wonder.
"Government man, huh? Like a police detective?"
"It's true, I swear. I had to get away from them, but the people downstairs, they don't know what I am, you see, and they might not believe me if they found me, I mean."
"Uh-huh. So you got to lie low for a spell, right here. Is that it?"
Her smile broadened, and I could have cried out in relief. "Yes, yes, exactly." I gave her my most appealing leer. "If I might stay for just a little while, I'd be most grateful, I assure you, ma'am."
"Call me Hannah,"
chuckled she,
"and just try to leave."
She swayed majestically forward to lean on the four-poster in what I can only call a worldly attitude,
teasing an amber tress between her fingers and pushing out her lower lip. And as I recovered my wind and appraised her at close quarters, inhaling a gust of sweet, heavy scent, and noting the ravenous glint in her eye, why, do you know, all of a sudden it was like coming back to life again after months in another drab and dismal world, and my immediate terrors and those of the past few hours were dwindling away. By heaven, though, she was overwhelming. 16 magnificent stone if she was an ounce. But light on her feet as a dancer, pug-faced pretty in an overblown way, and with a jolly sensuality in the thick purple lips and flaring nostrils spread across the fat, shiny cheeks. Well, not my vision of Venus, exactly. But it seemed as though centuries had passed since Mandeville. My randy imaginings of Elspeth were still fresh in my mind. And as I contemplated those enormous endowments fore and aft, and the massive, shapely thigh thrust out of her peignoir, I came over all a-tremble, pointing like a gun-dog. A languid smile became a hungry, complacent smirk.
"Say, that's better, Percy. I was beginning to think you was another Popplewell."
"Another what?"
"Popplewell, my lawful wedded 2 days back in Pittsburgh. First time for him, third for me, but my first white husband, you understand,"
she added proudly, drooping a plump hand to display a stone the size of a fives pill on her ring finger.
"Rich little run, too. How else you think he could bring his nigger wife to a Virginia hotel? Supposed to be taking me honeymooning in Washington. Oh, don't fret, honey, he's long gone. If I moosed on that train after the shooting, pale's a ghost, the dirty dog. Left me flat, and this was going to be my wedding night, too."
She glanced regretfully at the bed and heaved a sigh which shivered her top gallants, causing me to grunt sharply in sympathy.
"And me tricked up in my prettiest things and all," she continued plaintively. "You'd have thought it'd stay, wouldn't you?"
And before my enraptured eyes, she shrugged off the peignoir and put her hands on her hips and stood there bursting out of a flimsy corset, which would have been tight on Mandeville. She leaned forward, bulging magnificently, and pouted at me with lips like cushions.
"Why, you?"
says she, soulful-like.
"Wouldn't you?"
"No doubt about it, I've been lucky with women. But then, as the fella said, the more you practice, and no one has striven harder towards perfection than I, but Mrs. Hannah Popplewell was a double stroke of good fortune. First, because her presence in Harper's Ferry, which afforded me a refuge, was a chance in a thousand, and secondly, because she was one of those insatiable ornaments of her sex who would rather gallop than go to church. And just what I needed after a hard night's rebellion against the Commonwealth of Virginia. If her conduct was forward, well, her connubial expectations had been dashed by the recreant Popplewell, and the arrival of Flashy with whiskers rampant must have seemed like the answer to a randy young matron's prayer. And if you wonder that I succumbed to the brazen bitch's advances with peril threatening on every side, don't. Fear has never damped my ardour yet, as Sharif Saib's harem, into which I blundered accidental during the Battle of Patusan, could tell you. And the contents of that corset, flopping out voluptuously under my very nose, banished all thoughts but one. I buried me face between em, nearly crying, and wrenched at the laces with one hand while discarding me breeches with the other, which ain't easy when you're suffocating, but love will find a way. Taken unawares, the coy little flirt squeaked in pretended alarm. "Easy, boy," giggled she. "The door. Gotta shoot the bolt." "Leave that to me, I seized handfuls of rump, kneading away as she struggled playfully, making feeble noises of protest.
"But, honey, you ain't even told me your name yet."
"Allow me to introduce myself," I chortled. And with one tremendous heave, I hoisted her up, all black and glossy, into the firing position. Her eyes bugged out of her chubby face, and with a silent scream, she enveloped my mouth with those enormous lips, heaving against me. I reeled back, muscles creaking,
as she surged up and down. My stars, it was like wrestling an elephant. My legs hit the bed and I collapsed supine beneath that ponderous mass of ebony flesh, wondering whether I'd be crushed or smothered, but resolved to die game. For a moment it was touch and go, for the selfish slut had no thought but her own lustful gratification. But then she remembered to take the weight on her knees and elbows, as a lady should, and settled into a fine raking action that sent the bed jerking across the floor and brought the canopy down on us. I could tell she'd done it before, so I settled to the enjoyable task of holding those gigantic black boobies at a safe distance, letting her have her head, and as we plunged ecstatically past the post, I thought, "Good riddance, Popper, well, she'd have been wasted on you." It had all been so deuced sudden, flight one moment, fornication the next, that I was glad of the chance to lie and take stock afterwards, listening to the bride's contented lip-smackings, and reflecting that J.B. and Joe had more to do than fret over me, and the last place the citizens would think of looking for an absconding raider was the upper floor of their hotel. It wouldn't be safe to play the government agent card yet a while, though, and better by far to lie snug and safe, rogering this prime piece of dusky blubber, until J.B. skipped town, as he soon must, or perish, then wait for night and slip away unobserved. Or, better still, shave off my beard and whiskers, wait until tomorrow if need be, muffle up well and board a convenient train, perhaps with Mrs. Popplewell on my arm to lend colour, so to speak. With the hotel at sixes and sevens, they'd never look twice, and she was the sporty kind who'd think it a great lark, provided I continued to give satisfaction in the meantime, which I was soon called on to do. It seemed that I'd no sooner slipped into a ruined stupor before she was billowing all over me again, slipping her tongue into my ear and whispering, as she teased away with practiced fingers, that I was her show-nuff honeymoon baby, of all things. And whenever she saw a cucumber after this, she'd think of me, and similar endearments. She'd no notion of leisurely lovemaking, either. 30 seconds of gentle dalliance, and she started behaving like the Empress Theodora, run amuck, with poor old Flashy fighting for his life, belaboured by balloons of black jelly. Capital fun, mind you, but gruelling. And so the morning wore away, and myself with it. Meanwhile, there was little disturbance from without. Now and then there would be a few shots, but whenever I looked out, the state of play seemed unchanged. J.B. and Co. ensconced around the armory gates, but taking no harm from the occasional sniping. And now and then some of the townies would even approach the railings to confer with them, without result that I could see. It was a damned rum business, when you think of it. A quiet little town being held up by a gang of fanatics to no apparent purpose, the two sides taking potshots and confabbing by turns, and folk going about their business a stone's throw away. I couldn't fathom J.B. at all. If he didn't move, he was done for, but he seemed content to sit and wait, while the precious minutes ticked by. I gave up at last and bedded down, and had the horrors when I woke to find that Mrs. Popplewell was absent and the door ajar. But at that moment I heard her on the landing saying she'd take the tray in herself because Mr. Popplewell was still abed. Plain tuckered out he was. This with a lewd giggle for the waiter's benefit. And here she came, fat cheeks wreathed in smiles, bearing victuals and news.
"Such a ruckus down there. They don't know who's in the place and who ain't," says she. "So lean to and hit that fry, Mr. Popplewell. Gotta keep that fine frame of yours fade, I reckon. Come here, honey, and let me nuzzle you."
She engulfed me lingeringly.
"Say, though, your man Smith, or Brown, what's his name, got himself treed, but good, they said. Militia coming from Charlestown, and soldiers, and everyone's scared to pieces that the niggers'll cut loose and massacre the white folks, and raise Cain all around. Here, try this cornbread, darling. 'Tis succulent. And they talkin' real wild, say they're gonna burn this brown fella alive when they catch him."
She shuddered between gargantuan mouthfuls.
"I declare he must be crazy, freein' the niggers. Whoever heard the like? Anyway, just so long as they don't burn you up, big boy. Mo' coffee?"
She poured,
And no Belgravia mama ever did it more elegantly, tipping in the precise amount of cream without a drip. And as I considered her, noting the delicacy with which those enormous fingers handled cups and spoons, the erect posture on the edge of her chair, the assured tilt of the splendid Zulu figurehead with the flaming red curls spilling over her shoulders, I found myself thinking back to my conversation with Joe on the night flyer. You don't approve of abolitionists, then?
Damn right I don't. Running off black trash for your hands and low-life niggers to freedom? Think that makes them free? They gonna be slaves long time, yeah, whether they got emancipation papers or not.
She tossed her head.
Your friend Smith, old Show Brown, must be a fool to think he can free him. No white man can. Only us niggers. In here.
She tapped her brow.
Like I did long time ago.
How was that, Hannah?
Why, you know how.
She slapped my hand, chuckling.
Soon as I saw a white man look at me 10 years back, when I was just 16, not as big as I is now, but well-fleshed, you know, and when they saw me shaking as I went by.
She stood up and took a few steps, swaying with ponderous grace and rolling her eyes.
I says to myself, Hannah, gal, you toting your fortune around right here, and don't make no matter whether you black or white or sky blue pink. You just shake that meat, and you never go hungry.
More soberly, she added.
Sure, I's a gal, but every nigger, everybody, got something to take to market if they got the spunk and gumption to make the most of themselves. You is what you think you is, and that's why I'm a lady.
She had determined to catch a wealthy husband.
But I went mad for this colored gambling man in Frisco, and was wed and widowed inside a month. Yeah, Billy shot two fellas in a faro school. One was a chink, so it didn't signify, but t'other's white and a blacksmith. Mighty valuable man. So Billy got hung, left me nothing but his watch and $22. Then I married Homer, a lot older than me. Mulatto gentleman he was. Lent money to the colored folks, nice little business. But he up and died on me in bed.
Happy Homer, thinks I. No wonder.
He left me tolerable some, but little Hannah see the only real money's white money, so I set me to catch some.
She sipped at her cup complacently.
Took time and a heap of patience till I snagged Popplewell. Owned shares in half the canals in Illinois. Bachelor gentleman, gauged me as housekeeper. I see right away he was crazy for black meat. Wanted me to be his fancy woman, but no, sir. I says, you want a bed, you got a wed. I can't marry a negra, he hollers. Then you can go without, I says.
She whooped with mirth, dealing me a playful slap that almost broke my leg.
My land, how you went on, a-pleading and entreating, and I just kept a-shaking till he was fit to boil over. You must be mine, cries he, nigh weeping, so I says, why, whenever you please, Mr. Popplewell, sir, but you got to bid for my hand afore you gets the rest of me. So he did last week, and we was wed in Pittsburgh, regular Episcopalian, and he still ain't had the rest of me.
She giggled, admiring her ring with deep content. And the little Juggins ran away, on the train last night,
greased lightning off a shovel.
Says she cheerfully.
I can't bide violence, says he all tremblish. We must fly my own, for wasp befalls. I says, you can fly, Popplewell, but I's comfortable right here. And he flew. Meet me in Washington, dear creature, and here's $100. Do not fail me. They was his parting words. So I'll meet him in my own sweet time. Meet his canal shares, too.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.